He was like, come over. We're at the Chateau Marmont. I was like, is there a pool there? He was like, yeah, there's a pool. And I was like, okay. So I thought I was going there to go swimming. I showed up in my swimsuit, my swim trunks and my towel. I had like a little towel and I knocked on Matt's door and Corgan answers the door. And I don't know anything about the Smashing Pumpkins. I never met him. I wasn't even sure what he looked like really. And anyway, like Billy answered the door at the hotel room and they were telling me about this new band they're forming and Jimmy was there. I knew that they were auditioning bass players. There was just a guitar lying around and I picked it up and I started doing this Guitar Center trick where you just show off. You know, I started playing all these Yngwie Malmsteen licks and stuff. I was like doing all this, like straight up showing off. And I saw Jimmy and Billy look at each other like, oh fuck, look, this guy can fucking play. You know, that was it. I had the job.
Welcome to Discograffiti, the podcast that gives Gen X music maniacs a chance to smell like teen spirit again by connecting with a brotherhood obsessed with rating the entire discography of every single artist and band that ever mattered. I'm your host, Dave Gebro, and with three new episodes each week, you're going to gain a comprehensive knowledge of an act's history and output and the time it takes to listen to one album. In this episode, we'll be turning our spray cans on David Pajo, part two of a very special five-part Pajo series. Episode two is Zwanicide, that is his quasi-collaborative misadventures with Billy Corgan in the supergroup Zwan, as well as a harrowing overview of David's suicide attempt in 2015. Please be warned, if you're sensitive to or triggered by suicide-related talk, that beyond the hilarity of the Corgan section, some of this stuff is very difficult material to listen to. Honestly, there's no question that the second half of this episode is the most emotionally raw interview in which I've ever participated. So stay tuned for upcoming episodes that focus on David's sprawling solo career, as well as Slint and related acts. If you know, then you know. But if you don't, then you're really in for a treat, because tonight's guest was one of the founding fathers of emo and math rock with both Slint and Tortoise, not to mention his ludicrously prolific, insanely high-quality solo career. But just on their own, his collaborations with Billy Corgan, Bonnie Prince Billy, Gang of Four, the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, Interpol, and Royal Trucks would qualify the man as a Hall of Famer. David Pajo is a legend. Okay, first things first, you need to know just how seriously I take this craziness. Discograffiti is heavily researched, and the music is always reassessed with fresh ears. We don't just cover albums. We do a searingly honest deep dive analysis of all EPs, singles, comp tracks, relevant solo work, and sometimes bootlegs and live stuff. Every release is slapped with an objectively accurate star rating between 0 and 5, which allows us all, the real reason we do this, the Tootsie Pop reward at the center of the rock and roll lolly, to come face to face with the true shape of an artist's overall arc. Coming up, we've got tons more Pajo, Alicia Bagnono from Bully, Vashti Bunyan, The Association, and Anthony Fantano. What a lineup. So don't miss out. Open up your listening app right now and click follow. And away we go then with David Pajo. The next thing here is definitely the most what the fuck pocket of your discography, which is Zwan.
Yeah, yeah.
So I hadn't heard Zwan in 20 years. It came out January 28, 2003. So like almost 20 years to the day. And I remember hearing it at the time and almost immediately dismissing it. And it was a hell of a lot better than I remember it. I don't know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I really actually enjoyed it this time around with no expectations. You know, I think at the time it was so much easier for me to embrace your sensibility than it was for me to embrace Corgan's.
Yeah.
I was and still am a fan of his, but at that time it was really much more Will, Papa M, not Zwan. But I love the tension of what it is that you do, what you bring and had brought to all the outfits you'd been with up to that point. Yeah. How did you find yourself in that collective? Because, you know, you have the Smashing Pumpkins camp and then you and Sweeney. Talk about the opposite, what seems yeah. like the opposite end of the spectrum. What were the early talks like, sensibility-wise?
Yeah, I guess the way I wound up in that band is pretty funny. You know, I've been touring a lot and I found that I was playing a lot of the same clubs. Like specifically, there was this club in Bordeaux, France, Jimmy, it's called. And it's probably still there, but I found that like every year when I came to play in Bordeaux, I played that club. It's this tiny little place. It's awesome. But at some point I was like, man, am I going to be playing like all the same clubs every time I go on tour for the rest of my life? Like, and I started to become curious about this other musical world, which was the mainstream world that I'd always sort of poo-pooed or dismissed, you know? I was like, well, what's that like? Yeah, you know, it's easy for me to judge it, but I've never experienced it for myself, so I don't know what it's like. So again, it was like curiosity and just wanting a new experience. That put the seed in my head that like, I wonder what it's like to be in a mainstream band. What's it like? People tell me, but I don't know myself. And then Matt Sweeney, I was mastering Whatever Mortal in LA, and Sweeney was there auditioning bass players for Zwan at the time with Billy. I was talking to him because we were both in town and I was joking. I was like, let me in on that shit. You know, it was just a joke. And he's like, dude, he was like, come over. We're at the Chateau Marmont. I was like, is there a pool there? He was like, yeah, there's a pool. And I was like, okay. So I thought I was going there to go swimming. I showed up in my swimsuit, my swim trunks and my towel. I had like a little towel and I knocked on Matt's door and Corgan answers the door. And I don't know anything about the Smashing Pumpkins. I never met him. I wasn't even sure what he looked like, really. I didn't know anything about the Pumpkins, despite having seen them at Lollapalooza like 5 times, because I was on the side stage with King Kong. I would watch the Pumpkins just more out of curiosity, like, why does everyone like this so much? Yeah, I'd watch the audience and be like, everyone's so into it. And I just couldn't fathom, like, the music wasn't engaging me as much as the audience being stoked about it, you know.
They're really so anyway, good, like, but it's also very mannered.
I don't know what it was. I just didn't get it. At one point I saw James Iha riding Corgan's neck at that Lollapalooza. This is when Billy still had hair. And it was like the way Angus Young would do it with Bon Scott or whatever. I was like, oh man, I don't understand this. And then, Billy answered the door at the hotel room and they were telling me about this new band they're forming and Jimmy was there. I knew that they were auditioning bass players. There was just a guitar lying around and I picked it up and I started doing this Guitar Center trick where you just show off. You know, I started playing all these Yngwie Malmsteen licks and stuff. I was like doing all this, like straight up showing off. And I saw Jimmy and Billy look at each other like, oh fuck, look, this guy can fucking play, you know. That was it. I had the job.
I mean, did those guys know about your work? They had to have known aspects.
They knew about Slint.
Did they know Slint or know of Slint?
That's a good question. Billy only told me about listening to Slint later. He said that I think it was some weird story. I don't even know if I should share it, but there were like being peeping toms, like watching some girl like undressing or something. And someone that was playing Slint while they were watching it. And he said it was creeping him out so much that he made them turn it off, which is a pretty good story. Cause to me, that's almost like an ideal way to listen to Slint while you're, you know, being a peeping tom. I like that it was that disturbing to him. He had to have them change the music.
And I love that the decision is not to stop watching the girl, but
That would not happen. But it was two different Chicagos that were happening, you know, there, because it was my tortoise view of Chicago. And then there is the Corgan view of Chicago, which is like Wax Trax. And I don't know what it is. It was a different world, you know. And so I think he probably thought I was a total snob, you know, or just pretentious and hated him. You know, I just treated him like any other music. You know, I tend to get along okay with difficult musicians, people who are known to be difficult, because I usually understand them, like why they are the way they are. Yeah, I usually get it. So like Billy wasn't a task or anything for me. Right. But anyway, like without auditioning, I ended up becoming their bass player. And then they got Paz. So I got relegated to third guitar player. When there's already two guitars and bass, I played a lot of 12 string, you know, and I played through a Vox. You know, I tried to distinguish myself as separate from the other guitars.
So were you allowed to really fly off on your own on the record? I'm not really sure who's who on there guitar wise.
Man, I have a CD of when we were still writing the album of just me and Matt, Paz and Jimmy, just all our parts for the songs. And Matt and I worked really hard to have all this guitar interplay where we're intersecting and we'll join at times, then we'll split off and play these complementary parts. And we worked out all this intricate stuff, and Billy just put bar chords over everything, you know, just like swamp, like you can't hear any of the stuff that we did. I would like to dig up those CDs just to show to people.
There's all this stuff around that time. In doing the research for this, I found out that some of the 40-minute collage of interviews and performances and stuff from the bonus DVD of the record are from an aborted film.
Oh, that was going to be an all-acoustic version, like an unplugged version of the band.
Okay. Were there big plans then for the band? I mean,
yeah. I think he wanted it to be, like the new Pumpkins without having to be beholden to the history of the Pumpkins, you know?
Or just the Pumpkins minus crack cocaine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, minus the drugs. Yeah. I don't know what to say too much about that band because it was, you know, my curiosity was satiated about that part of the musical world.
Like the big time.
Yeah, I was also seeing the big time through Billy's lens, you know, so seeing the big time through Karen O's lens is much different, you know, it's much more.
What is the big time through Billy's lens?
The difference is it's more like ego driven. I'm trying to be democratic with my words, but it was more like old fashioned in a lot of ways too, like the old fashioned style of rock star. And, you know, I don't know what it's like now, but I'm sure he's adapted to the current musical climate.
I mean, he's got a triple concept album. He's 2 out of 3 records in releasing right now. So I don't think times have really changed for him.
Oh, okay.
he's still reaching way high up on that ambition mountain.
Oh, cool. You know, yeah. I like that he's reaching out there. I don't know. I just, at a certain point, you know, you want to be able to enjoy what you're doing, and you don't want it to feel like a job, and you don't want to think about numbers and what the masses think. At a certain point, you just want to go. Like, I think I just wanted to go back to making music that I love. So I would do those, like the Pop M tour diaries, those singles. I would do those when we were on breaks, just because it was refreshing. Like, it was like a breath of fresh air to me. It was like.
Yeah. Now, did you feed off the dichotomy? Like, I'm doing stuff that was not inspiring to you because it was a job. Would that be your inspiration for creating raw and real art?
Totally. I think that's almost the only way I can work effectively is if I'm going against something, you know, slints. Oh, shit. I said it.
As my son does. He goes like this.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I get the finger, too. Like the wagging finger. Like, no.
Your kids are teens, right?
Yeah. They're teens, but they still do that kind of stuff to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, just the desire to do something different that wasn't currently being done. The desire to sing because everyone thought of me as an instrumental guy. You know, right. I feel like I do better when I have something to fuel me to go against, you know.
Punk sensibility without the punk music.
Yeah. That's the sensibility. That's where that comes in, where that becomes fuel, or like Zwan was feeding Papa M at that time. It was like a relief to do my own music or do music that I felt something about. That's definitely like a theme for me where I have to be almost like rebelling against something. I'm trying to think of what I'm rebelling against now. I think now that I live in California and I'm around the LA world, which is kind of culture shock for me, because in Kentucky, having ambition where you want to be the next big thing is pretty much laughed at. People will be like, man, who do you think you are? You know, you got to wipe your ass just like me. You're like, and I love that you're humbled, you know. And in LA, it's like, and I'm not saying everyone's like this, but there's a greater percentage of people that all want to be the next big thing, and they're all ambitious. Everyone's just hungry for that. And you know, you're talking to them, but they're looking over your shoulder to see if there's someone more famous they can be talking to. And when there is, they'll run to them, you know. And I think now my thing is I'm really against that, and I'm into just being really not common, but not trying to be the biggest big thing, not caring at all about numbers. Not that I ever really did before, or like trying to win fans or publicity or anything. Like, all that stuff is kind of, I understand it's like part of the business, but it's not what drives me when I'm writing a song or when I'm playing in front of people I look up to, you know, like that's not the kind of stuff I care about, really.
It was surprising that I enjoyed the record as much as I did. It's a long album, and there's not a lot of moments in it where I'm checking my watch. I really authentically enjoyed it. I don't know if you remember, Heart Song, Jesus Eye, Mary Star of the Sea. I think really good stuff. But, you know, the one thing that I'm kind of bummed at from a conceptual angle is that Billy didn't utilize what was truly at his fingertips, which if you marry the sensibilities of what he had, which was still strong, still going strong at that time, and what you and Sweeney brought to the table, that's something that there would have been no precedent for.
And that was what we talked about originally. That was the original idea, was to, you know, it'd be a meeting of the worlds. And then once the recording started is when it all changed, you know, where it fully became Billy's thing. And that's, yeah, that's when it all changed. And when I started to lose interest too. So
if it was like, you know, glam alt folk, that's interesting, but it just glam is not as interesting.
Even when we started the recording, the stuff that Matt and I were doing was trying to, you know, use Billy's, like he would come up with the songs or he would have final say on the songs. And then we would try to do stuff on guitar that would make it compelling for people that maybe, I don't know. We just, it was like a meeting of minds, but I think it all, that all got sort of steamrolled, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
The band, we kind of just fizzled out, you know, we were on tour in Europe and then.
Well, it was 7 months after the record came out, he put an end to the band, right?
Yeah. And he just ended the tour and stuff. It was, you know, he and Paz were butting heads because Paz was never intimidated by him and would always speak her mind, like to her credit, I think. So he ended up kicking her out and he asked me if I would play bass. And I think I just never replied because my idea was that if Paz or Matt isn't in the band, then I don't want to be in the band. So as soon as he kicked her out, I was like, okay, that means I'm not in. So it's just he and Matt and Jimmy now. And then he just dissolved it. We just all sort of stopped talking to each other, except for Matt and Paz and I. We all stayed in touch.
A good friend of Nastanovich, whose name is Patrick Fleming, wanted me to ask you if there were ever discussions about a Zwan reunion.
Wow. Gosh, if there were discussions at all, that would be surprising. Because I haven't talked to Billy since then. You know, I think the last I heard from him was that email asking if I would go back to playing bass. That was his idea for the band at that point. I haven't seen him or talked to him since then. I mean, I would read stuff in the press where he was dissing me and blaming me for all this stuff. And
Billy, I know you're listening. Objectively speaking, Zwan is a more inspired record than anything by the Pumpkins since then. And so what you need to do is go back and revisit what you had at your fingertips, which was something completely unique and wholly special and a one-off. And utilize those ingredients instead of holding them at bay. You heard it here first. And Paho's not going to tell you, but I'm going to tell you. And it just is how it is.
It's incredible.
It's true. I mean, it could have been and could still be a really amazing thing if all the components are utilized.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't mind reunions so much. Actually, I don't mind reunions at all. But to me, it would be maybe a step backwards to, like, I feel like there's more exciting things in the works. One band around when Zwan was around was called Children's Hour. And I was playing drums with Children's Hour, who is Josephine Foster. I don't know if you know her. She was originally from Chicago, like folk singer. Mm-hmm. And Andy, also from Chicago. We were a trio and we opened for Zwan, but we were playing this kind of quiet folk music for these stadium crowds. And I was playing drums, this tiny little drum set for them. So I'd play drums with Children's Hour, then I'd play with Zwan afterwards. Like, once again, I was still in multiple bands. We unearthed the Children's Hour recording that we did right after the Zwan tour. I've been so obsessed with it. I love it. We are going to release it eventually, or it's coming out hopefully this year. It's almost, I'll say the other S word. It reminds me of Spiderland in the sense that we were kind of at the top of our game, and then we just recorded it really fast. And then we forgot about it, and then we just left it alone. You know, I didn't think that recordings exist, and then we dug it up 20 years later. Like, the songs are some of my favorite. It's one of my favorite recordings I've done. I can't wait to share it with you. I think you'll dig it.
I'm psyched to hear it. Yeah. You know, I'm not insinuating that your work with Zwan is like potentially the most interesting work you've done, but you embracing hitting the big time, there shouldn't be anything fucked up or weird about that, because I feel like if anyone deserves it, it's you. But in an outfit that is not just about hitting the big time, but, you know, having aesthetic success too.
My parents are funny. I mean, they're parents, so they love, like, I played on Letterman 4 or 5 times with different bands. I played on Saturday Night Live twice. They love the TV stuff. And to me, that's like the least interesting stuff. But when Zahn was happening, I remember my mom telling me, she was like, I'm so happy that you're getting all the success, like after all your years of hard work. And I was like, Mom, like everything I've done has been a success just because it didn't exist before I did it. You know, to me, my idea of success is if I can imagine a song or a band and then it happened, make it happen, you know, it's good or bad is beyond me, but just making music happen, that's success to me. So,
and so how did the Yeah Yeah Yeahs happen? And did the experience with Billy make you nervous to sort of reinsinuate yourself into a sort of reaching for the big time outfit like that again?
That was just another thing. They needed somebody for a tour.
It's Blitz.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the person they had, it just didn't work out for some reason or another. And it was like 2 or 3 weeks before the tour started. They were like, we have to find somebody else. Lance Bangs had shot Breadcrumb Trail and recommended me. I was familiar with them more as people than I was their music. At the time, I was playing in Dead Child, and I just thought that sounded really exciting. I think if something is unlike me or seems really different, I want to check it out. You know, I can't help but be curious.
So then entering the 2010s, you become a member of Interpol for, I believe, it's about 9 months, right?
Yeah.
Was that just one of those things that came about? They needed a helping hand?
Yeah, exactly. Which is how I ended up in a lot of bands. You know, they lose a member and they need someone to help them out quickly. And I guess I can learn songs pretty fast. And I'd run into Daniel Kessler when I was on tour with the Yeah Yeah Yeahs. Carlos, who was the Interpol original bass player, like he was in the process of leaving, or maybe he just left. And I think he saw me with the Yeah Yeah Yeahs and thought I would be a good fit. He's a fan of my early solo stuff too, which I was really surprised to find out. He knew it all. I was really surprised.
Yeah, mainly I'm surprised because their band is all about, you know, reaching the back row in terms of the kinds of noise that they make. And that's
absolutely, yeah.
Well, after that was Household Gods, which is sort of a super group, right? So you have
sort of, yeah.
You, Vern Rum, I don't know what supergroup means, so I have to couch it in, you know, quasi terms like that. But
musicians
you,
with a past.
right, exactly. Yeah. Vern Rumsey from Unwound, Conan Neutron from Secret Friends and Replicator, and Lauren K. Newman from Palo Verde and LKN. So this is kind of like inspired by the Desert Sessions and just seeing what happens in the moment, right?
Yeah, yeah, it was really low key, at least the way it was presented to me. And at the time, I was kind of recovering from a lot of changes, you know, and I hadn't done music in a while. I was, you know, I'd had a suicide attempt, I'd had a motorcycle accident and 13 surgeries, and then I was in the hospital like forever. And then, you know, I relocated to the other side of America. I was on the East Coast and I moved to the West Coast. So I was going through all these changes and not doing any music really at all.
I know you've been vocal, you know, about that time, and I wasn't skipping over it because I was afraid to talk with you about it. I was going to talk about it elsewhere. I suffer from depression and have for quite some time. What kind of process is it to come to a place where you just offhandedly mention things like that?
Wow. That's a really good question. The process, I think it was pretty much immediately after my attempt, like maybe within 48 hours of my attempt, where I just decided I was going to be really vocal about it. And that was 90% because I put my suicide note online.
Yeah.
And so I had to own it, you know?
Right.
And I just thought it was a great opportunity to make this taboo. I remember telling my brother when I was still in the hospital after it happened, I was like, you know, suicide is so huge and it's everywhere. We all know people that have died by suicide. We all know people that have attempted, you know, some of us have attempted ourselves. Like, why don't we talk about it? Why is it like this? You know, we talk about cancer and we talk about all these other alcoholism and stuff, but anytime suicide's brought up, we're like, oh shit, I'm so sorry that you had that. Shh, let's just tiptoe around this because suddenly things have gotten morbid, you know, like let's go back to something positive to talk about. And I just wanted to get rid of that and just make it so that I could casually talk about suicide, not to diminish it, but to take away this fear of like, oh shit, we shouldn't go there, you know, because we absolutely should go there. It's huge.
Hey, lads and ladies, Dave Gebro here. I abandoned my career and moved my family 3,000 miles to be able to focus exclusively on Discog Graffiti. And so if you're like me, and enough is just never enough, then please visit patreon.com/discograffiti and become one of our Patreon soldiers of sound. Discog Graffiti is an entirely listener-supported show, and it's also intended to be a 3 times a week music deep dive experience. So do us both a favor and consider giving it a shot. Trust me, I'm working hard for the money, so hard for it, honey. There's the main show on Friday, a Monday wildcard episode, which is either a soul-bearing interview with that week's special guest, or an offshoot show like Queasy Listening and Rock Cousteau. And then on Wednesdays, there's the humdinger of them all, Discog Graffiti's The Private Press with Paul Major. You got nothing to lose. If you don't dig it after a month, you're refunded. No questions asked. Once again, that's patreon.com/discograffiti. The first thing that I thought when I heard that you had attempted that was, you know, it made me upset because for a long time, I was familiar with your music and your music minds, the same pain that would lead one to either think about that being a thing or, you know, to come to terms with feelings that might lead to that, or if you get some kind of comfort in the notion of being sad. Your music, there's a lot of sadness and a lot of fear in it that I get from it. In the best music you've made, there's a palpable sadness and palpable fear of what I get is like fear of the unknown or fear of, you know, massive sweeping energies carrying one away. Was this something that the notion of which always felt like a relief that you could go there at some point should you decide to? Or was it out of the blue all of a sudden you felt like not being here?
Man, that's a tough one to answer because I did ruminate on it for most of the day for about 6 months, which is a long time to be thinking about ending your life, you know. It was from like 0 to 60 because I went from not thinking about it at all of a sudden it dominated my thoughts, you know.
And was there anybody that was your confidant during this time?
No. Yeah, I didn't really talk about it with anybody. I was seeing a therapist, and I think I brought it up a bit. But one thing I inherited from my parents is this ability to be really stubborn. And so once I put it in my mind, I was like, I'm just going to go through the motions like I normally do, like nothing's changed, but nothing's going to change my mind, like no matter what. That's how stubborn I get. So even though I was still going to therapy and I was bringing it up a little bit with her, not a little bit. At the time in 2014, it was ketamine therapy.
Did that help you?
I did it a couple times and it did help. It was really intense for the 45 minutes that you trip out or whatever.
Yeah.
And it was all really monitored and controlled. And you talk about it afterwards while you're coming down, like with your doctor. It did help, but I went in with it like, with the thought that even if this helps, I'm still going to do it. You know, that's how stubborn I get. I'm not going to let anything change my mind. It helped in the sense that I had these revelations that I wish I would have taken to heart. The first one was that everything's going to be okay. You know, like if I just let nature unfold and do its thing, let time sort of level playing fields, everything will be okay. And that was a revelation I had on my first ketamine session that I just didn't listen to that, I guess, or I just chose not to listen to her.
Were there aspects of taking care of yourself afterwards that you had to start looking into that you weren't doing previous to that?
Yeah. The main thing was just not letting myself believe the seductive lies that I was telling myself. And I say they're seductive because they have their own logic, you know, and you can really convince yourself of some dark shit, you know, like the world will be better off without me, that kind of stuff. And they're lies. They're straight up lies, but they're really convincing. I just was able to see those convincing thoughts as red flags, you know, and not to believe them. So, you know, just anything that kind of makes you seem less than anything else, you know, like, or And you're doing it, it's self-inflicted, you know? So it's always a red flag if you're diminishing yourself, you know, calling yourself ugly or worthless, unlovable, fat, you know, any of this stuff that diminishes yourself. They're all lies. You can really convince yourself that they're true, but they're not true, you know?
I'm guessing that all the people that you've known through your life showed an intense groundswell of love. It had, that had to have happened.
It was unreal. If I hadn't put my note online, I mean, I don't know how things would have been different afterwards, because so many people came out. It was an avalanche of love. You know, I couldn't, it was hard. It was impossible to ignore. And I can't forget that. Putting my note online and surviving was one of the best things that's ever happened to me. But one thing you said about, you know, I've always had 1 foot or 2 feet in dark, more, you know, melancholy songs or whatever lyrics. Like, I've always been attracted to that kind of music, or that music speaks to me, you know. But I think my approach has always been sort of what I saw in other artists, you know, like, well, Leonard Cohen comes to mind, like where you face these darker emotions that are really rich and beautiful in a lot of ways, but you do it with a sense of dignity. And I think I lost that dignity for those 6 months. I want to be able to talk about that or sing about that stuff or whatever, almost in an objective fashion, like I'm watching this sadness happen to me, you know, like any lyric that says, like, I want to die. I would always laugh at those lyrics when they're in hardcore songs, you know, because it was just too, yeah. I don't know. It just didn't resonate with me.
One consistent image that's really helped me is to think of sitting by the side of a stream, and the stream is rushing by, and I don't need to throw myself in the fucking water. I don't have to do that. All I got to do is just watch it go by.
That's right. And the stream is like your oppressive whirlwind of thoughts. Is that what you mean? Because that's the way depression works. Once you're in the water, it's like layer upon layer until finally it's a weight that's so heavy you can't stand anymore, you know? And that's why people say, like, when I finally talked about it or I vented about it, it was like a weight was released, or when I reached this change, because it really is a weight. It just crushes you.
And I still feel it. You know, one of the great things about substances is not that you get super high, but that crushing albatross seems to be.
Oh, that's the danger too. Yeah. Because it's the only relief sometimes. And it just feeds it at the same time. It just makes it stronger.
Some of the best work that you've ever done seems to navigate these veins, what can be very dangerous areas of aesthetic insight. You know, I remember being around 19 years old and feeling, when I was listening to Syd Barrett's solo records, that this is kind of dangerous. I'm entertaining this and I'm inviting this on myself. And the more you listen, the more you're not fixing that hole.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I don't know if you were like me, but you also kind of romanticize or glamorize the junkies, you know, like the Lou Reeds and the Jim Carroll and Burroughs, like the substances were part of the mythology, you know? And so I don't know, how are you with the substance abuse now? Like, is it, if you don't mind me asking?
No, I'm asking you all these questions. It's been a struggle because, you know, I had 13 and a half years clean and sober, and then cancer and two neck surgeries within 5 months, and they had me on morphine, Norco, you know, and that was my really my sweet spot. Marijuana has been a consistent one for me. I have to be careful because, you know, my modes of thinking, they're optimistic and wondrous, just like I'm sure yours are, but they slide right into the gutter given half a chance.
Yeah. I mean, I totally hear you there. I haven't been clean as long as you have. I don't think I've ever made a vow to be clean, but I almost never drink. I don't have any desire to, but like marijuana, I don't know if I should get into all this, but like marijuana, I do feel is medicinal. I take an edible just to help me stay asleep. I don't have a problem falling asleep. I just wake up right away. But when I was in the hospital, I had the same thing. I was away from all kind of hard drugs or whatever for so long. And then when I was in the hospital, I actually graduated to Dilaudid, or I requested it because the morphine was too trippy for me. And Dilaudid was, I was like, God, that's the only drug I could imagine going back to ever. Like, because which is such a shame, you know, because there's nothing I can be addicted to other than, well, I even quit coffee, but Dilaudid is.
If opiates were not bad for you, I would be
we'd all be in the opium dens.
I mean, it just, look, I don't have a lot of inhibitions, but it takes them all away. I can enter into
the power you get from opiates. That's the thing is, like, I don't want to encourage people to try them, because in fact, I think that if you've never tried anything like that, you're good. One thing I wish I'd never tried. I don't regret anything, any drug or anything I've tried, really, except for heroin. I feel like that was the one thing that really took away all my problems, physical and emotional, at least for the seconds that I, you know, the moments that I was on it. And it always comes back worse. You know, I knew all the dangers, but I don't know, when you're that desperate, I think you kind of live for just a little bit of relief. But I just think it's best if no one just has the experience. You know?
It's not good to know that you can feel like that, because as Jeff Conaway said before he overdosed and died from celebrity rehab, life is pain and pain is hell. And if you're not aware of that and you're floating by on a pink cloud at all times, when the shoe falls, it's going to fall hard. You know, if a parent dies or you get let go from work, if you're just used to feeling good all the time, it's going to sting.
What you're saying is it's going to sting with more dramatically than if you hadn't been using.
Yeah, because, you know, you're rewiring the internal landscape of perspective to expect to feel good.
Yeah.
And that's dangerous.
Yeah. Man, that's really true. Like now, I really like life's edges. I used to do stuff to take the edge off of life, you know, to kind of round it off a little bit. And now I really love the sharp focus and the edges of sobriety.
Did this experience, did it turn you towards sobriety? Is that what happened?
No. Now, I mean, I was always part of the challenging yourself thing was I sort of also got off on quitting addictions. I don't think I really ever had too much of a problem with stuff. But I think being in the hospital and having a taste of all that stuff again wasn't good for me, because I kind of relapsed into some things afterwards when I was home from the hospital. It started off just to take the pain away, and then it kind of evolved into, well, now what am I going to do? Because I was also, you know, after my motorcycle accident, I was stuck in a wheelchair for 2 years in a tiny little apartment. My whole going outside thing was like just sitting on my front porch. So it was like, I may as well be high as a kite while I'm sitting in it, while I bide my time getting off. So, but it wasn't good. You know, I regret it, because I'm also a dad. You know, I hope my kids never hear this.
Yeah. You're very vocal about it, so it's not like they know about this, right?
I haven't had the talk yet with my daughter, who's old enough to get it yet, about my attempt, but that's coming up. I'm sure she's probably heard about it.
Yeah.
And she probably has some questions too, but maybe she's scared to bring it up. So I need to have that talk at some point, but it hasn't happened yet.
I'm really glad that, and hoping really that you remain free of the notion that you would need to do something about that again.
Yeah.
That it's a wonderful life thing of, I don't see myself, and I'm really wondering what, if anything, is my fucking point here. That it's enough to drive you mad, but you play a part in this world. You definitely do. And I don't know, I'm tripping over myself trying to create some profundity here, but I'm just glad that, you know, you just didn't try harder than you did.
Yeah, I'm really, I appreciate that. I mean, I can't even put it into words how thankful I am that I'm still here to be able to talk to you right now, you know, and to make more music. Yeah. I thought that was it. I'd convinced myself, like, I had a good run. This is probably a good place to end it. But I've also, like, since then, I've been just as stubborn now about never getting to that point again, you know, no matter what. Like, I do take medication. I started taking it after my attempt. You know, working with a doctor, I found a little cocktail that's not too bad for side effects. And I finally found what works for me. And if I have to take it for the rest of my life, I don't even care. You know, like, whatever it takes to never get to that point again, I'm going to do it. Because, you know, who am I to be so arrogant to think that I know when the right time to end my life is? You know, nature's going to do that anyway. Why do I have to rush it? I can't be pompous enough to think that I know better than nature. I'm not dating anybody now, but my last girlfriend that I fully had a love relationship with, I guess, I remember telling her that I thought it was weird that in relationships, when it comes up, at least when you're not married, like when, you know, when there's no piece of paper saying that you've made this public vow to each other, when you're in a girlfriend-boyfriend relationship. So I always thought it was weird when someone would just be like, well, what, should we break up? You know, when there was a conflict, like, we can always break up. That's always an out. But I thought the point was that we were trying to work together to solve the problem. You know, like, I thought we'd made a, you know, that we were a team trying to solve problems, rather than as soon as a conflict shows up, we should just break up. You know, I never understood that way of thinking. It's like, as soon as a problem comes up in your life, you lose your job or something, like, you should just kill yourself. That's not really the answer. You know, I understand that depth of despair to where you see that as the only only relief.
It's also not pretty being middle-aged. There's nothing romantic about sticking and staying and working through issues. And, you know, this real slump shouldered ho-hum kind of shit, at least on paper. You know, it's like the David Foster Wallace, This Is Water speech. I don't know if you've ever heard that. He did a commencement speech, and it's something that you could conceivably listen to daily. And it's just about, you know, a fish don't notice that they're actually, that they live in water. And even though they don't notice it or talk about it, it's everything that's happening is that this is water. You know, the down moments that really make up life. On the way home from work, you know, you realize, oh shit, there's no food in the fridge. You got to stop by. There's a long line at the checkout counter and, you know, somebody's fumbling for their cash and it's taking too long. That's basically life. And that life is really a reflection of how well we handle those bullshit downtime moments. That's the measure of who we are as people.
All you have to do is put me behind a wheel. Once I start driving, all my love for humanity goes out the window. You know, I find myself just constantly complaining, you know, like the entire time. And it's all about people not making choices that I would make. No one ever drives the right speed for me. There's no right speed, but in my mind, I think there is. It's never the right speed. They're just in my way always. One good thing, well, several good things came out of surviving my attempt, but one of the best things is my gratitude for all life and all of its facets, you know, like including the shitty moments and the, you know, the person driving really slow when you're late for something, you know, like I'm just stoked to be on this planet still to experience it, to experience the shitty side of life. I'm actually happy about that, you know, because it's better than not being here at all to me, because I get to see my kids grow up. I get to make more music. There's a lot of unfinished stuff that I'm really excited about.
You still have to stay here so that you can create a sonic landscape that's suffused with despair so that people can continue feeling shitty.
Yeah, that's right. That's my job here, is to continue to spread the despair.
Exactly. It's crucial that you keep reminding people that you're staying above the morass, that this stuff is something that you are a part of and, you know, very deeply, intrinsically a part of, but yet still you're one flew over the cuckoo's nest. The most recent thing is you joining Gang of Four. Is that like a music nerd, like, holy shit, someone pinch me kind of a thing? Because that's a full circle kind of a deal for you, isn't it?
Oh, totally. Yeah. When I get a message from anybody in Gang of Four, I'm still just like, this is so cool. Because I was a Gang of Four fan for so long. They're just this mythological thing. And I can't believe that I'm a part of it. And I love talking to them and hearing their stories. And it was cool as well to realize that I was more influenced by Andy Gill than I ever realized. The songs felt so normal and natural to me that I didn't realize how much he actually shaped my guitar playing, because I used to listen to them a lot, especially in college, but I mostly listened to the bass and drums because I really loved the drum beats and how the bass and drums were like this machine. And then there was this Jackson Pollock sort of guitar happening on top of it. And the vocals are really like you were at a social protest or something. They're really chanty. I love the guitar playing, but that wasn't really what I loved the most about it. But when I started learning the songs, I was like, I wonder what I would be playing like if I had never heard Andy Gill. His vocabulary is absolutely a part of my language, you know, using harmonics and just trying to coax bizarre sounds out of your guitar without using a whammy bar or excessive distortion, using these to try to step outside of the box a bit.
They sound like razor slashings.
Yeah.
You know, like At Homie as a Tourist. I mean, that sounds like a violent thrust of a razor blade or something.
He always did this choppy thing where it almost sounded like the guitar was shorting out or something, you know, like an arrhythmic kind of stuff that was really cool. It's been really fun playing with them.
Do you have any use for terminology that, for whatever reason, the kinds of music that you play, the prefix post is thrown on there? That's post-punk, post-rock. Does that mean anything to you, or is that just a sack of shit as far as verbiage goes to describe what it is that you do?
When I was younger, I used to hate those kind of terms. And now I understand them, like, especially people that work in music, they need a way to sort of categorize things. And put things into compartments. Now I realize a band like Can never thought of themselves as krautrock, you know?
Right,
but
right.
We associate them with krautrock. You know, Tortoise never thought of ourselves as post-rock. We didn't think of ourselves as anything, but now people associate us with that, or Slint even. I understand it, how it helps for other people talking about music or art, really, is, you know, it's just kind of a fun abstract thing that I think you use words that are kind of like arrows pointing at a thing, but it's too big for words.
Yeah, the words are actually the arrows. They're not the thing itself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially post-rock. I really don't know what to do with that term. And you're kind of right at the origin point of that.
Yeah.
Just nice to see that you're able to kind of play in a sandbox. It really seems like a full circle indicator that you've been on the right track your whole life.
Thank you. Yeah, I think I definitely have a track. And that is the direction, you know, that Gang of Four, I mean, I never would have imagined it in a million years, but it totally makes sense. A lot of this of me doing solo stuff is to find out what my sound is, because I'm not entirely sure what it is that I bring to these bands, except for maybe some kind of intangible thing.
We need that Pajo flavor.
Yeah.
How many times do you think that's been said, whether in a boardroom or not in a boardroom, before you were summoned?
Yeah. And also in relationships, when my exes are like, we don't need that Pajo flavor anymore. We've had enough for that. Go on a diet.
All right. That about does it. A heartfelt Discography thanks goes out to our graphic designer, Todd Zimmer, my beautiful wife and son, Jen and Mason, David Pajo, Drag City, my incredibly loyal fans, and especially the entire Patreon community, the Soldiers of Sound. I love every last one of you, and this show would not exist without you, my friends. Speaking of friends, it's high time for some new ones. They're in our Facebook group, Discography Soldiers of Sound. That's the best way to find out what's coming up on the show, but there's a hell of a lot more. You get recaps of the day in music history, the ability to pitch questions to guests, polls that put you in the driver's seat on guest and band decisions, access to a thriving creative hub if you're looking for a collaborator, and much more. So make sure you don't miss out. You can find the link to the Discography Soldiers of Sound Facebook page right there in the show notes. And if you don't mess with the Zuck, no sweat. Just email me at info@discography.com and I'll keep you regular, as it were. But wait just a minute. This is just the entrance to the rabbit hole. Join us as we descend down, down, down on Discography's week-long Pajo Peyote Deep Dive, wherein we train the microscope down on an embarrassment of bonus Pajo and the first in a four-part series about Cold Sun. Another way to dive even deeper is to get thee directly to Pajo Part 1, which is Episode 94, not to mention the Pavement series and the Lou Barlow series, where I Gen X'd myself to death from Episodes 49 to 62, with the help of Lou himself and the ever-congenial Bob Nastanovich. Of course, if you're a Patreon subscriber, then you already know to keep your ears peeled throughout the week, because this Monday continues our Pajo Peyote Deep Dive theme with the Patreon-only wildcard episode, the David Pajo Patreon Collection Volume 2, in which Pajo and I talk about the various wild and wacky spiritual practices that get us through the day, his band Dead Child, and the shocking death of House Household Gods bandmate Lauren K. Newman. Not to mention Wednesday's incredible Patreon-only episode of Discography's The Private Press, part one of a four-part interview series with Texan psych legend Bill Miller about his insanely great band Cold Sun. If you don't know him and you feel like maybe you could just skip the episode, I want you to please picture the underground bunker that literally was built to house this record down in Corpus Christi, Texas, by legendary man of swell music taste, Ashley Johnson, seeing as you don't want to fuck around down in hurricane country when you possess the only copy ever made of one of the greatest records of all time. Yeah. You heard me right. In addition, I can't recommend enough that you tune into our brother podcast, Vintage Annals Archive. This week, it's episode 13, Eddie Davis, with a particularly interesting focus on the stories of old school Jewish musicians in Philadelphia. The great Rich Wexler, who actually had Eddie Davis perform at his bar mitzvah, talks with Eddie about working with Chubby Checker, knowing Daryl Hall, and a cornucopia of other stuff. Rich is doing amazing work over there, so don't miss it. That's the Vintage Annals Archive podcast. And of course, be sure to mark your calendars, because next Friday, June 2nd, we're coming at you with an interview with Bully's Alicia Bagnono on the day of the release of her brand new Sub Pop record, Lucky For You. No surprise, but it's yet another great one. No surprise again, we take her hand and dive pretty damn deep as she becomes our tour guide through the new LP. And so, from now till then, don't let our youth go to waste, lads and ladies. It's Discograffiti.